has a Bible on it, I'd get you to John chapter 6. There are some stories that we engage in the Scripture that it is right to deal with the whole story. And John chapter 6 is 70-some verses long. And if you are familiar at all with Bible reading, you know that that's a substantial chunk of Scripture all in one place. And we're going to work through that because that whole story really belongs together as we work through some significant moments that Jesus really instructs his followers or potential followers. To set it up, I want to just kind of work through very quickly the first 20-some verses where there are two stories that if you have any church background at all in you, chances are you've heard. And if you don't know the stories well, you will after this morning and you'll leave here a little bit smarter than when you came. There are two moments in Jesus' early ministry where he is teaching a group of 5,000 men plus their wives and their kids. And there's a dilemma that happens after a long day of teaching where they don't have any food to feed this significant crowd. And the disciples come to Jesus and they're like, what are we going to do? And Jesus says, well, we'll feed them. And they don't have much food, but Jesus, through a significant miracle, feeds the 5,000 that afternoon. And it amazes the crowd. Later that same day, after Jesus is done, he leaves and his disciples leave and they get in a boat and they are traveling across the water and they become quite terrified because of the conditions that are on the water. And Jesus, to add more terrifying moments into the heart, he begins walking on the water and his disciples look out and see him walking on the water and he comes in and has this conversation. And these two stories really are the first 20-some-odd verses of John chapter 6. And what I want you to hear in this story is that the people who witnessed these things, the legend of Jesus is starting to grow. Like, you can't feed 5,000 people and that not cause a stir amongst the villagers, if you will. And they begin to see Jesus as someone who can actually improve their life, that he can make their life better, which is really the motivation as to why they begin following him in the first place. There are two verses that really speak to this in John 6. We'll put them up on the screen. But they were searching for Jesus because they believed that he could make their life better. The first one is in John 6:15, where it says this: Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force. What this is getting at is that the Jews of the first century where Jesus is living, they are ruled by the Romans. And they hate the fact that the Romans are their king, that this is who they have to serve. And they view Jesus as someone who can actually overthrow the Romans. If he can feed 5,000, if he can do walk on water, surely he can kick out the Roman Empire in his power that he has. So they view Jesus as someone who will make their life better by kicking out the Roman oppressors of their day. This is one of the reasons why they begin following him, why they're searching for him. The second reason is very, very simple, and it's in John 6:26. Jesus says this to the crowd. He says, you're looking for me, not because you saw signs that I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. In other words, the only reason why you're here is because I gave you bread. You don't like me, you don't understand who I am, but you're going to follow because I'm a one-trick pony for you, and here's some bread. And they follow along, and this is one of the heart reasons why they are pursuing, why they're searching for Jesus. It's interesting that the person in the first century is just like you and I in the 21st century in that we are always looking for things that will make our life better. We all do this. I'm no exception, where there are things like that would make my life better. So we get a new phone. We get a new laptop. We get a new car. We get a new spouse at times. We like get things that are new, hopefully to solve the problems that we are experiencing to make our life better. This week, kind of driving around the city, listening to a radio station, and they said, this is awesome. And if you try this, anyway, here we go. To make your life better, to have the greatest day that you can have, when you get up in the morning, try this kind of shower routine. Like, this is the level at which we will go to make our life better. So when you get up in the morning, get in the shower and have a 30-second cold shower followed by 40 seconds of warm water to finish with 30 seconds of cold water again. And you will kind of arrive in the workplace sharper than the other one. Well, of course you will. Like, you've just frozen yourself in the shower. Like, It doesn't make you smarter. In fact, it makes you the dumbest one in the room, is what happens. But this is this desire that we have to make our life better. We will try ridiculous shower routines that we would have the best day possible. Take it from others, like, just don't even shower. Like, who cares? Like, have a great day. Like, just enjoy the day. We are a people, like them, that are constantly looking for things that will make our life better. Jesus, and this is what I want you to notice, Jesus recognizes this issue in us, that we are always looking for the next best thing that will make our life here in this world better. And we're going to throw this up on the screen because Jesus helps us with this. He says, if you're going to work at making your life better, then put your efforts into the right things. John 6:27 says this. This is Jesus speaking to us. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures. If you're going to work at making your life better, don't waste your time chasing things that spoil. Chase things that will endure forever. And Jesus follows up with this statement with a huge hint, and we'll go to that next screen, Ethan. And Jesus kind of leads us into what ultimately he's getting at. He says, which the Son of Man will give you, for on him God the Father has placed his seal of approval. We play a game sometimes with our kids where you'll hide an object in the room and then you say, go find it. And as they look around the room, you're like, cold, hot, cold. You ever play that game? All right, good parents. Jesus does not play this game with us as it relates to how we increase our life here on earth. He doesn't say, there is a way you can work that is awesome, and then says, hot, cold, as we kind of search for ridiculous shower routines. Like, those are foolish on a whole lot of levels. Jesus says, if you're really after increasing your life, making it better, then work for food that does not spoil. And he kind of gets rid of all the commotion and says, and it's connected to me. It's connected to me. There's no one else who can solve what you're really after in this world other than me. I am the food that does not spoil. Pursue me, pursue me, pursue me, pursue me. Now, the central part of John chapter 6 is in verse 28 and 29, where the disciples, and this is more than just the 12 disciples, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of men and women around asking great questions. And when someone asks a question in the scriptures and you see the question mark, pay attention. If you want to increase your handling of the scriptures and as you read the Bible, look for the question marks, because that is where you will find profound answers that are connected to your life and living. So the disciples asked Jesus a series of questions about the kind of work that they must do that will, in fact, make their life better. After they ask the question, Jesus answers them. We're going to put the exchange up on the screen. This is verse 28 and 29. Then they asked him. Who's they? The disciples. They asked him, what must we do to do the works God requires? Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. To believe in the one he has sent. The rest of John chapter 6 is Jesus explaining what this verse actually means, or what this phrase actually means. What does it mean to believe in the one who was sent? And this is the whole point of John chapter 6. Before we get into the rest of it, I want to highlight for you a term that most of you will know, and it's called a metaphor. If we don't know what a metaphor is, we will find the reading of any book, let alone the Bible, difficult. A metaphor is where there's kind of an analogy of like, well, it's kind of like this. I know that's a simile for you English teachers. Similes like and as. Metaphor is the same thing. It just doesn't have like and as in it. But the metaphor, so I'll give you some examples. The psalmist writes that the Lord is my rock. It's not saying that Jesus is a rock that you carry around in your pocket, that you pull it and say, the Lord is my rock. Like, if we do that, that's like weird. Like, that's weird. It's a metaphor. When Jesus says, gouge out your eye, or cut off your hand, or cut off your foot, he's not saying, cut off your hand. He's not saying, gouge out your eye. I love playing games with people who want to kind of engage the scriptures from the literal perspective. And I'm like, how come you have two eyes? How come you have two hands and two feet? Well, Jesus didn't mean that. And I'm like, well, but here you want to be literal, but here, where it actually costs you something, you don't want to be literal anymore, chicken. And you kind of tease them, and hopefully, you know, next time I see them, like, oh, you finally got rid of your eye. Good. So metaphor is significant. It is significant as we work through the scriptures. And the disciples are the one that introduce the metaphor that Jesus is going to use to teach the rest of the way through John chapter 6. And this is how they introduce the metaphor. What sign will you give us that we might see and believe you? What will you do? Our ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Now, I want to just quickly, for those that don't know, this is referring to a significant moment in Israel's history. Israel is leaving Egypt. They're headed towards Canaan. And they find themselves in the desert with absolutely no food. And God sends them manna every day to eat, or basically bread, pita bread. Anyway, sends bread that they get up in the morning and there's bread for them to eat so they might live. This is the story that they're referring to. Moses gave us bread that we might believe. What will you do that we might believe you as we believe Moses? Jesus picks up on the manna bread story and he begins to teach them. And he begins to teach us. And this is where we're going to spend the rest of our time together this morning. If you're wondering what is the work of God, which is to believe in the one who is sent, this is it. Jesus, through three metaphors, explains to you and I what it means to believe in the one who is sent. Metaphor number one is in verse 32, where Jesus teaches them who is responsible for the manna. They think the manna has come from Moses. Moses brought manna that brought life. What will you do? Because we know that you're from Mary and Joseph. And Jesus comes back to that and says, no. Like I'm not from Mary and Joseph. They're my dad and my mom, as you understand it, but I'm not from them. I am from the same one who gave the manna, which, FYI, is not Moses. God is the one who sent manna through Moses. God is the one who has sent me, the new manna, the new bread, through Mary and Joseph. They're my mom and dad, but not as you think they are my mom and dad. I am sent by God for the work of God through Mary and Joseph. Does that make sense? The first thing that Jesus is trying to highlight here is this. If we are going to increase our life and work for food that does not spoil, it's a recognition that Jesus has been sent by God. He is more than just a carpenter's son. He is more than just Mary's boy from Bethlehem. He is the Son of God who has been sent by God for your life's sake. This is the first space that this metaphor gets played out. The second one is this, and we're going to spend some time here. Jesus in John 6:35 says, I am the bread of life. It's one of the great I am statements that Jesus says. There's nine of them. And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Now, I need you to hear what Jesus is telling the crowd, because he's telling them in the whole manna bread metaphor that's on its way through this whole story, he is saying, I am the one, like the manna, that if you eat, your life will flourish. Focus all your attention on me. And if you do, your life will increase, your life will flourish, and it is spectacular how this gets played out. One of the great benefits, and there's many, but I'm going to highlight one here because Jesus highlights one here. Eight times through John chapter 6, Jesus says, if your attention is on me, if you trust me, if you know who I am, you will live forever. Eight verses in John chapter 6, Jesus says, if you believe me, if you trust me, you will live forever. And you're like, well, why does that matter for my life now? Well, that's a great question. Let's move into that answer right now. There's a philosopher named Irvin Yalom, and he writes this. He says, we are forever shadowed by the knowledge that we will grow, blossom, and inevitably die. This shadow of death shapes our life in every way. In fact, there are some studies that suggest that our entire life, everything that we're afraid of, is actually driven by our fear of death. It's called terror management theory. You can do some reading around it. It's quite fascinating. You will see yourself in the studies. There are two aspects to the terror management theory in your life and mine, and this is what they are. The first aspect is this. Knowing that we will die, we will work our tail off to make our name great so that when we die, our legacy will live on. To stick it to death, I will work hard, get trophies, get ribbons, get all that I can, get my name on cubicles, so that when death finally arrives, it hasn't ultimately killed my name, because the Woodworth name will live on and on, even though I've died. It motivates us to ultimately say, you will not erase my name from the history books. The other way, and this is where it gets really personal for us, the other way in which death shapes our life is this. Do you know that every single anxiety disorder ultimately is connected to your fear of death? Every one of them. How many of you don't like to fly? Well, it's because you're scared of dying. How many of you don't like snakes? Well, it's because you're scared that you would die in a pit of them. How many of you don't like, you can fill in the blank. It all comes back to your fear of death. How many of you are constantly checking locks, checking curling irons, checking stoves, checking kids while they sleep because you're scared that someone or you will die? It drives our life in so many areas. How many of you are scared of clowns and vampires and werewolves? This is why. Imagine the horrible death of being beaten up by clowns. Imagine the horrible death of being stuck in a room with rats. Imagine the horrible. It drives our lives in so many areas. If you have a fear of clusters, you're just weird. Like there's no, that's a different category, weird. But the vast majority of our anxiety disorders in life ultimately are connected of a fear of death. And it gets shaped, it shapes our lives in so many different ways. Now here's my point. Imagine the quality of your life, the joy that you have, the peace that you have, when you know that death isn't in the cards for you. Imagine that you would live your life with no fear of death because of Jesus Christ in your life. I've told you this story before, but for those of you who haven't, I'll tell you the story again. I remember the first time we got on a plane to take our kids to Florida. We were in the, I don't know what it's called, the waiting room before you get on the plane, and our oldest son, Eden, who is 7 at the time, is nervous. Like, he's afraid to get on the plane. And you kind of lean down and you have the conversation, like, why are you scared? And he's like, well, I don't want to crash. I'm like, well, me neither. But who's all on the plane? Well, you and Mom and Eden and all the sisters. And I'm like, so even if we die, what happens? He's like, well, we all die together. Yeah. I'm like, more than that. What happens if we die? Well, we get to go be with Jesus. I'm like, well, let's get on the plane. Like, let's get on the plane. Like, there are ways in which we communicate subtly to our kids that they actually need to be afraid of death. When we understand who Christ is, he says, you don't need to fear it because you're going to live forever. Imagine the anxiety that we all would drop if we believed Jesus' words as it relates to what is to come when we physically die, knowing we'll be with him, knowing that we'll be raised with him again, that we will live forever because of who he is and what he will do in a few chapters later down through the Gospel of John. The last metaphor is this. And this is the very weird part of the story. Jesus begins to talk about, if you're going to believe in me, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. This is metaphor. He's not actually talking about eating his body. That's weird. He's not talking about drinking his blood. That's kind of vampire-ish. Like, that's not what he's advocating. What he is saying is this, to believe in the one who is sent by God, which is Jesus Christ himself, we ingest all that he is to the point where his words become my words. His life becomes my life. His motivations become my motivations. His purpose now defines my purpose as a follower of him. There are many verses that speak to this. I'll read some of them to you this morning. Matthew, one of the other gospel writers, writes it this way. He says this: whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Mark, another gospel writer, says it this way: whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the sake of the gospel will save it. Paul, another follower of Jesus Christ, writes it this way: I have been crucified with Christ. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God. John, a brother to Jesus, the writer of this book, also wrote another book, and he says it again: whoever claims to live in him must do what Jesus says. And Jesus, in the clearest way possible, says it again in Matthew 7, and he writes this: enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate, and narrow the road that leads to life, and few find it. Therefore, whoever hears these words of mine, and puts them into practice, is like the wise man who built his house on the rock. To believe in the one who is sent by God requires an effort on our part to pay close attention to the teacher and learn from him as it relates to every aspect of our life. The crowd is listening to Jesus work through these metaphors, and they have a significant response to it. But before we get to that response, I want to throw these things up on the screen that you might see what Jesus tells them as it relates to the question they've asked: what are the good works of God that we should do, which is the food that will not spoil? Here they are. Number one, believe that Jesus has been sent by God. He's just not from Mary and Joseph. There is a different source from which he comes from, and it's from God himself. Number two, we look at Christ as though he is the one who ultimately satisfies. I'm 38 years old. You've heard other people talk about it. You're going to hear another story in a moment. Christ is the one who brings peace, contentment, joy, satisfaction into our life, period. And it sets us up for a great life to come at our physical death, where we know in him we will not die. We will continue on forever and ever and ever. And number three, while I live on this earth as a 38-year-old husband, father of four, pastor, human being, with great effort, I will work to put to death, another metaphor, put to death all of the things that used to define my life, my ways, my thoughts, my understanding of things, and I will learn from Jesus how I'm to live my life for his glory and for my greatest joy. The disciples, this large group that are listening to him, this is their response to Jesus' words of what it means to believe in him. He says this: on hearing it, many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, "Does this offend you?" Does this offend you? From this time on, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Many of us love the idea of Jesus. But a lot of us, when we understand what he's asking, we are just like the disciples who turn back and say, "I'm going to do things my way because I think I know best," to our demise. This morning, you've already heard from two people who have shared a bit of their story. I'm going to invite Sherry to come. She's going to share her story. Would you welcome her to the stage this morning? Thank you.
I grew up going to church with my family, but when I was 20, my mom died. I got angry and turned away from God. I was full of fear, and I worried about everything. On the outside, I looked fine. But on the inside, I had a longing for something more. At first, it would come as a feeling of something missing that I only noticed every now and then. I would tell myself I was just having an off day, and I would distract myself and try to make myself feel better by buying material things. And it worked for a while. As the longing grew, I decided I needed to make a career change. And I read a lot of self-help books. And that worked too for a while. At its biggest, the things I had always thought would make me happy if I had them, the things that are the closest to my heart, my husband, my family, my home, my career, still couldn't fill that something. And that's when I realized there was nothing I knew how to do on my own that was going to end that searching. I had to give up control. And that was a rude awakening for me. I'm reminded of the story of Nicodemus, how he lived his whole life a certain way, believing he understood what he needed to be doing, only to be told he was completely wrong. I started coming to Cornerstone with some friends late last summer because I honestly didn't know what else to do. They really believed it was what I needed. And although I was unsure, I had hope. I had no idea how it would change my life. The Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend, we had the chance to share the things we were thankful for, and we were invited to stand and be prayed over. Pastor Phil asked if there was anyone who had allowed distance to come between them and God, but in their hearts would like to start to rebuild that relationship. I thought he was talking to me. It was not something I had ever done or would have ever thought I would do. But I was convicted that day to stand up and through faith accepted Jesus into my heart. I have found such peace. Most days I can't even describe it. I don't have the fear, anxiety, and worry anymore. I love God, and He shows me every day that He loves me. I'm so excited to serve the Lord and grow in my relationship with Him. Romans 9:16. I raised you up for this purpose, that I might display my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth.
Go downstairs now.
Dana and team are going to come and lead us in a song. Our baptism candidates, they're going to make their way out and get ready as quickly as you can. Mike McIsaac, could I just get you to go downstairs and encourage the foundations to come up? When your kids come up, moms and dads, can you kind of call to them? Over here, sit over here. Just because we don't, it's the open session downstairs, and normally all of the leaders would come and sit with the kids, but if they can find you, and if they just run up here because they want to get wet, then let them come up and get wet, and we'll just try hard to get them to where you are. We'll sing, and then I'm going to come back, and I'll share with you a few more thoughts as we move into our celebration of baptism. Let's sing together.